First of all, on behalf of CSIS, I'd like to welcome you all here. My name is Bill Garvelink, and I think we're going to have a very interesting session today. As many of you know, ICRC was created in 1863, established as an independent humanitarian organization, and its mandate is to protect the lives and dignity of victims of conflict and internal warfare. And ICRC, as we all know, focuses on the international humanitarian law and promoting humanitarian principles in providing humanitarian assistance. They're sort of the guardians of all of those things for the international community. ICRC is a big organization. I think you have about 12,000 employees in Geneva in about 80 different countries, something like that. So you're scattered much larger than USAID, where I come from, scattered around the world and engaged in the most difficult situations that we all can individually think of. Just to come to the International Review of the Red Cross was started in 1869, so that's a very old journal, too. I think the issue we're going to talk about is the 884th issue or something like that. It's been around a very long time. And I'm glad there are copies here. I read mine on the online, and I recommend it to you. There's some really good articles in here. There's about 12 or 13 articles. There's an interesting interview with former ICRC President Kallenberger and the EU Commissioner for International Assistance as well. So there's some really interesting items in here. And I just made some notes in terms of what's in the journal, and it raises a bunch of the difficult issues that we're all dealing with individually and collectively as groups. And it's the challenges that civilian and military actors are posing to international humanitarian law, the use of force in humanitarian action and in protecting civilians, the targeting of humanitarian workers, there's an interesting article that focuses on all the new actors in the humanitarian field and their different perspectives from ours, or basically Western perspectives. There's a growing focus by humanitarians on capacity building, and that has implications for how we relate to folks who emphasize development and that sort of thing. And then the impact of some very big trends that affect everything: urbanization, population growth, resource scarcity, climate change, and those sort of things, and the implications of that for humanitarian action. And then the changes in technology. They're all having an impact on how we do our humanitarian business. I'm really pleased to have Pierre Cranbloul. I've always had a hard time with your name. So from now on, I'm just going to say Pierre, and then we're okay. I couldn't think of anybody better to come and talk about these sorts of issues. Pierre is the director of operations at ICRC and has been since 2002. He joined ICRC in 1991 and served in El Salvador and Peru and Afghanistan and in Bosnia. And at headquarters, he was the head of operations for Eastern Europe. That's right. Special advisor to the president of ICRC. So he comes with 20 years of experience in all of this stuff. And so it's my great pleasure to turn it over to you, Pierre. It's all yours.
Thank you so much, Bill, ladies and gentlemen. Great to be here, first of all. Thank you, CSIS, for this opportunity today to formally launch the review that you've very aptly introduced in terms of its historic background, its purpose, which is really to engage also publicly with a number of stakeholders on some of the key humanitarian issues of the day. And we've had past reviews focusing on issues like engaging with armed groups or issues also like urban forms of violence and warfare, as well as migration issues around Iraq and Afghanistan specifically. So it is a tool and a platform to have discussions and contributions in particular from people from academic, practical, and practitioner background. So it's, I think, something important to highlight, and it's a very important opportunity to be here today to launch this particular edition dealing with the future of humanitarian action. And if you allow me a few observations to start this discussion, looking very much forward to the exchange with you later, a bit about some of the trends that we observe in the humanitarian field and in the context of armed conflicts around the world, in particular how they are changing around us and how the environment to work in these armed conflicts is developing. I'll begin with a couple of initial observations about trends in armed conflicts, and I think one of the first comments to make is that the nature of armed conflicts that we deal with today is incredibly diverse and varied. If you compare it to the period of the Cold War, which was certainly also a very complex and demanding phase, but was clearly within a very strong ideological framework and sets of paradigms, which you could recognize in certainly in different forms and shapes, but in many conflicts of that time, whether it was in Angola or the Central America with the conflicts in Nicaragua and in El Salvador, and also, of course, the Afghan phase of that phase of the Afghan conflict with the Soviet invasion and others. So you had that overarching set of themes in very strong ideological terms that was very present. Today, the majority of armed conflicts that we deal with, first of all, are no longer between states, which, as we know, was a very predominant feature for a long time, the so-called international armed conflicts, opposing states directly. Today, 95% of all of the places that we work in are internal conflicts, civil wars, if you want to use that terminology. And the other part is that they are very often around a mix of issues, in particular also around vital access to critical resources, and that can be access like land or water or, of course, oil, but also other minerals like we see in the DRC as being a tragically prime example of that type of trend. And one of the things that is related as an observation to the diversity of those conflicts is also the very great diversity of actors. So we deal currently with some of the most technologically advanced armed forces, of course, when we engage with U.S. forces, NATO forces in Afghanistan, where we have extensive dialogue and engagement with them on detention operations over the past decade, on conduct of hostilities. That's our jargon for saying that we intervene with forces about their track record in terms of respecting international humanitarian law, whether or not they have taken all the measures to preserve civilians in their military operations. But we also do the same with the other side in the equation, which is we also sit down with the Taliban and discuss about those issues with them on their use of improvised explosive devices, suicide attacks, and what that means. So that is, of course, the other end of a spectrum. And then you have, in a range of other contexts, of course, very loosely organized, poorly equipped militias, gangs, and different forms of actors. Again, the context that Bill knows extremely well, which is the DRC, where we're currently dealing in the east of the DRC with 50 different factions. And those that have, we've heard a lot about in recent days and weeks, which is the M23 and the governmental forces, only two of those, the rest, the 50 others. Of course, they change their names and affiliations very regularly, and it makes it a very unpredictable environment. Unpredictable for us, but that, of course, is only one part of the story. What is in particular strong is unpredictable for the population, because they absolutely every single day live with the fear that an armed group will come through their village, loot, rape, abuse in the multiple forms that are there. And I think one of the things that one has to then also identify as very significant in most of these crises today is the fact that not only are the situations diverse and the actors diverse, but the average length of the conflicts of today is something very important to note, because most people associate at least the humanitarian side of the work with the emergency response, the peak of the crisis, the fact that you have Gaza, like recently, 8 days, very intense. But in fact, if you look at Gaza for those 8 days, or if you look at it previously in 2009 around the CAST-led operation, those are indeed peaks of crisis, but that are only the visible part of what is a chronic and long-term protracted situation of armed conflict. And there you can take most of our big operations, Afghanistan, Iraq, which is currently a context that few people still speak about, although during most of the weeks of this summer, there were on average more victims of armed violence in Iraq than in Syria, which is something that currently is, of course, not at all identified by most. And these are all places which are therefore characterized by two things that I think are also important to have in mind when we think about armed conflicts, which is on the one hand that recent years have shown that very, very few armed conflicts are actually decided militarily on the battleground, on the battlefield. That you have, yes, there was the case of the victory in the Sri Lankan conflict of the government forces over the LTT. But you have very few of those instances, and even fewer cases where you have a negotiated settlement that is a way out of, we can just go around the table and think of when was the last time that we saw a structured peace negotiation lead to a settlement that would have been accepted by all parties. We can all think of Dayton, which was needed the U.S. base in Dayton to have people locked up to eventually sign it, but with all of the consequences in long terms that are still not fully resolved in the Balkans, but at least it brought stability in that sense. But there are very few instances, and I think this is one thing to reflect on, if I can just leave us with a first sort of message around that. I think, as Bill indicated, we have many debates in the humanitarian community about blurring of lines of distinction between political action and military action and humanitarian action. What we think is very much called for today is a re-engagement by states in terms of the political management of most of the armed conflicts of today. And I say this not because the ICRC has a role in that, but because precisely we see, and we are in so many contexts that have now been lasting for so long, that we could meet again in 10 years' time and presumably continue to talk about many of the same situations if they are not handled also in political terms. And that's where one of the big challenges comes today, because the international community, in its political expression, be it through the United Nations or the states community, has in fact still many of the tools that were adapted to a world in which conflicts were predominantly between states. And so the UN's New York office, but even the one in Geneva, which today has turned primarily into a humanitarian hub, but was for a long time in the 1980s, 70s, a place where political dialogue was taking place. Parties would be called from the Iran-Iraq war and other conflicts to sit down. And whilst the war was going on, there was a process that was leading to dialogue. Today, that is extremely rare, also because the majority of conflicts are taking place within states, and therefore states are, of course, extremely sensitive about not having outsiders who already carry out humanitarian work, so imagine how sensitive they are about their national sovereignty when it would be to have an outsider come and negotiate with their internal opposition. Not to mention that most of them are then labeled for years either criminal or terrorist, which raises the price for engagement in political terms even higher. Now, whatever we think of the sort of political rationales and underlying issues in a given context of conflict, which is, again, not the angle that the ICRC will have, but our concern is the lasting consequences on populations of the fact that these processes, these contexts, are not being managed politically in ways that are maybe more effective. And, sitting beside Bill, I'd remain very modest in terms of my looking at a context like a DRC, but realizing also how challenging, when I spoke of these 50 groups, it is to build a process where they would be part of looking for a future in an armed forces that is united and built as integrated, or joining a parliament that may be the future political dynamic in the DRC, as opposed to trying to benefit from the illegal extraction of the vast mineral resources in the country. So, of course, very many reasons why this is difficult. The other points I wanted to highlight, of course, is that we're currently, with a number of issues that have come recently with the context of so-called the Arab Spring, which is, of course, a dynamic that has created further significant areas of some of the political dynamics and social dynamics, extremely interesting and also very important. But in terms of instability, certainly with Libya and Syria, the two contexts that were the most unstable that then turned into open armed conflicts, and for the case of Syria, probably currently one of the most, in human terms, catastrophic situations altogether. And I don't, like to engage in ranking of suffering in the world, so it's not that it's more or less important than the suffering in DRC and Afghanistan or other places. But it's just the intensity of it currently is, of course, absolutely devastating. And that has been, for us, one of our primary operational challenges, is also how to have a response in this context that is relevant to address key needs of the population in medical terms, in assistance terms, but also over time to seek to improve our access to places of detention, which is currently insufficient, and we can come back to that later in the discussion if you want. The other part of that particular question is also to look at how a situation like Libya, which was looked at last year from the point of view of protection of civilians, which then led to regime change, and then the spillover, as it were, or at least the regional consequences of that into the Sahel with northern Mali and the country now split in two, which is we are, with our teams in the north of Mali, present there, as was the case in Yemen to a large extent over the past year or so. We are therefore in face-to-face discussions also with some of the most radical groups that are present there, including Mujao and Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb. And that is a context in which when you have to deal with perceptions, it is a very delicate balance to find between operating in a context like that, providing medical assistance, providing people with food and other assistance, and being mindful of the context that one is in, with certainly under close scrutiny by the groups themselves about what the ICRC is about, how it works, but also how others on the outside will, you know, review the fact that we are engaged in this dialogue with groups that are as radical as these. And then, of course, another context that remains very important, I think, for many discussions also here in Washington currently is, of course, the process of transition in Afghanistan and all of the events of the gradual withdrawal of international forces, U.S. forces, the handover of security and detainee issues to the Afghan authorities, and a bit the question mark about what will the future look like in humanitarian terms. Well, first of all, in overall terms in Afghanistan, and I think it's really very difficult today to identify what the future of Afghanistan will be following this withdrawal. I don't think that anybody has that specific and definitive view on what will happen. I think when people say it will be the same as after the Soviet withdrawal, that's probably a bit short in terms of the analysis, because these are very different times and different circumstances. But I think for the humanitarian community, it will raise one big issue, because much of the humanitarian assistance in Afghanistan over the past decade has, of course, unfolded under the protective umbrella of international military forces. And so the question will be, as those pull back into Kabul and a couple of bases and withdraw significantly, I think one of the big tests for the humanitarian community will be how many agencies will retain an ability to operate independently from that security umbrella. And there, I think the hypothesis is not very difficult to take one step further and actually presume that there won't be a great number and that it will be a very different scenario. We see some early indications of that already today with agencies pulling out of different regions because of, well, in some cases, reduced funding, but in others because of questions about the future security management. And here it is a very important part to mention in the humanitarian community's overall ability to project a clear and consistent message about how it operates. We are currently in a phase that is changing a lot for the humanitarian community, and I just wanted to highlight maybe a couple of points. Staying with Afghanistan and the region, just to first of all say that, of course, we've had a lot of discussions in recent years about this blurring of line debate between the military and the humanitarian interventions with the PRT debates and others. Again, we can come back to that later. We also have a form of blurring of line debate around the case of the Pakistani medical doctor who was engaged, at least these allegations around his role in the collection of DNA leading up to the operation that led to killing of Osama bin Laden, then his arrest by the Pakistani forces, government, and the trial with reference to the fact that he was involved in all this through Save the Children, which of course then generated lots of debates in Pakistan around whether or not the humanitarians are and whether the story is true or not. The perceptions are out there, and they are out there anyway, because in most contexts where we work, many people do think that humanitarians are there for other motives than the ones that they announce. So of course, when you have unfortunate stories like these, that adds to the pressure. But the humanitarian community is also changing because the world around us is changing very significantly, and I think we all, you know, have been part of discussions about the rise of China and the different role that Brazil is today playing, and the way in which the Russian Federation wants to again reassert its own position, or if we've seen over the last 2 years more of Qatar and Turkey than many others involved in the political sense. Our hypothesis was always that this was going to translate into profound changes also in the humanitarian community. Now, when one raised that in the past, while everybody would nod when you talked about it in the political term, most people just, you would draw a blank in terms of the discussions inside the humanitarian community, which is the natural reflex of things will never change. But they are changing, and they are already very concretely changing. I can tell you that in most of the contexts in which we are currently involved in new situations like Libya, was the case for the first phase of Libya last year, Mali currently, Syria, but also Somalia to a large extent, although this is now changing a little bit, we don't find on the ground anymore the agencies that used to be or that you would expect to find in the past, which would be agencies like UNHCR or WFP or Save the Children and Oxfam and others. Today, we do, of course, these organizations continue to operate, but they are very often less directly present than they were in the past with their own staff on the ground. They will more work through intermediaries locally for sometimes very good reasons in security terms. But the agencies that we see more of today are Muslim charities, Red Crescent organizations from our own Red Cross and Red Crescent family. And this is only the beginning of a very profound change that is, by the way, happening around us and I think offers many opportunities. So it's not to now make a statement about being fearful around this, but it is changing. There are therefore, like in the political sphere, there are parallel narratives developing about what humanitarian and development approaches are about. And we're very conscious of the fact that it won't be enough to say that one should invite a few more people to one's own table. It is about going to other people's tables and sitting down, and as we have engaged also with the OIC's Humanitarian Coordination Office, Ishad, and others to really also learn about different perspectives. And as I say, this is before China's humanitarian response starts to develop and intensify, which is currently not its main priority, but it will come at one point, just as Qatar certainly has been very visible in a number of engagements there. So this is changing the landscape for us. And just to finish with a couple of other brief observations on some of our own challenges in operational terms. I referred earlier to Syria, Mali, and a number of other contexts. It's clear that the issue of making a difference for people is a key element. But for us, it's also how do we ensure that we obtain the access to these populations? Now, in the ICRC's interpretation of humanitarian action, that comes together with a very resolute defense and application of neutrality and independence, which not everybody across the humanitarian sector shares as a view, and which is fine. There doesn't need to be just one way of doing things, but that is definitely our way because we believe that applying those principles has a proven track record of leading to access in our case. It also means, as I pointed earlier, that we talk to everyone. We talk to the Syrian government and we talk to the multiple parts of the Syrian opposition. We talk to the Taliban and other groups in Afghanistan, as well as we will engage with government and opposition forces in Mali and in DRC and elsewhere. That is part of how we operate. And I think what is important in that is to be always recognized as a non-political actor in these contexts. That is, again, what enables us to establish trust and other elements. Bill referred to international humanitarian law, which is one of my final comments here in introduction. We've lived international humanitarian law being, as you know, the law that applies in armed conflicts, the Geneva Conventions and others, and we've had some fascinating debates over the last decade on whether or not they're still adapted to today's reality, and I just want to share one view on that with you. I think in particular after September 11, there were a number of debates around the fact that I think they went along these lines. The Geneva Convention is something admirable. Everyone should have a copy at home in their library, but actually when you take it out, you realize it's a bit dusty, and those inspired people who negotiated them at the time hadn't quite envisaged a world made up of, that included Al-Qaeda and new phenomena of that nature, which I think is a factually probably correct observation. But my point is always that the people who negotiated the Geneva Conventions, and these were seasoned military experts and diplomats that had just survived World War II, those were not people who needed a great deal of imagination to envisage the human capacity to inflict catastrophic suffering and devastation on itself. And so I think what is the reality is that international humanitarian law in the current form is the minimum consensus to have emerged from a disaster like World War II. So we need to take care of that and treasure it very, very attentively and then try and reinforce it and strengthen it as we go. And I think there's a number of initiatives that are underway that seek to achieve exactly that. So those are some of the parameters that certainly make the ongoing work of the ICRC and other humanitarian organizations very challenging, the context, but also the issues and the sort of changing paradigms around us. So I'm very interested to hear from you about your own views on that and take any questions that you may have. Thank you very much in any case for the opportunity.
Sure, thank you. Let me start and just ask one question, and I think you've touched on it, and maybe if you will just elaborate a little bit, and that's the providing humanitarian assistance by remote control. More and more folks, whether it's Somalia or Syria, and you touched on that, the organizations you're used to seeing in these settings aren't there anymore. There are local organizations or others, or with the technology that's available, it's cash transfers, and there's no oversight really over a lot of the activities. But I think it's changing how we approach humanitarian assistance, and I'm sort of curious in how you see that evolving and how that really relates to humanitarian principles as well.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because there's lots of things one can say about that, and I'll come to the remote control in a second. But let's start with this point. I think what has often been the case in the humanitarian family at large is that I think we measure proximity, in other words, direct implementation of programs, through the presence of the expatriate. That's what has historically been the case. Mm-hmm. And that's no longer how the ICRC sees that. And that's been several years that we do no longer exclusively measure it through that. And we have some very interesting debates with our colleagues in Médecins Sans Frontières, for example, who have challenged us, as they do, in numerous debates around the issue. You know, the phrase that went with them said recently, a few years ago, they said, you know, one of them said to me, Pierre, you're giving up your proximity approach. And they said, particularly, for instance, in Somalia, where we believe, you know, we have proudly kept up with a group of dedicated 40 very well trained and dedicated Somali staff that have kept the operation going for years. And so I was trying to understand what they were referring to. And they said, because you no longer have the expatriate presence, which is the measure of proximity. And there I just simply see that differently today. I think we definitely understand that our ideal scenario is where we have the perfect mix between locally recruited competencies and expertise that we can bring in from the outside. That's the ideal situation. But if we applied that today in the classic sense, we would not be in the north of Mali, because we have designed our operation around a colleague who is Malian himself, who's the head of the team, and a number of African expatriates that are in the context. So it is a different design than the past. Somalia is different. Iraq, for certain years, relied on a backbone of national staff. Now we're back to a mix with 100 expatriates and 700 national staff in Iraq. You have to have that agility to adapt your modalities. Now, the one that you're referring to in remote control, which is then very challenging, is how do you then ensure oversight for the implementation of your programs? I can give you an example today in Syria, where we have this year reestablished access to safe water throughout all of the major cities in Syria, including Aleppo, Homs, Hama, and all the others that have been affected, through contracting with local institutions, and both some of them are official governmental, others are local institutions engaged in reestablishing the waterworks. And that has allowed between 2 and 3 million people to reestablish their access to water. Now, in some cases, it's with direct presence of our expatriate team to oversight. In others, we have developed over years mechanisms to control, indeed, the remote implementation of those programs. But I think it is correct. You're right that it raises questions in some contexts, and we saw those debates in Somalia a few years ago with the debates that went all the way to the Security Council around these allegations of misappropriation of WFP distributions, including in the Shabab context and everything. So we know we're under pressure, and we live in a world today where everything is being monitored in that regard. And if you have a perception challenge and a reputation issue in a context, it's going to travel very, very fast. Now, if I can add one point, Bill, to that, I think it's also very important to note one other change that is probably not yet fully recognized by us as humanitarians, but is there, is that with the access to new information technologies and the social networks and others, the historic I think, self-created or perceived role of humanitarians as intermediaries between the person at risk and the victim of a situation of conflict and public opinion in countries, third countries or in other countries around the world. But of course, the media also played that role. But humanitarians who would tell the story of suffering in the different contexts, that intermediary role has disappeared because people don't need you as an intermediary or us as an intermediary anymore, because they just go on Facebook, on Twitter, and put their own story out directly. And mostly those stories are not, you know, always very consistent with the other stories that the humanitarians are telling, because if you've had a humanitarian come through your village, well, that may be presented by the humanitarian as access, but if your needs have not been addressed, you're certainly not going to present it as very relevant or meaningful. So that pressure is going to increase. So we'll have the monitoring and the scrutiny from the donor base and those who provide huge amounts of money for the humanitarian system, and an increased scrutiny by beneficiaries and people themselves. So we'll be in a very different setting there.
Well, let me ask one more question, then I'm going to open up. So think about what you may want to ask here. This sort of goes back to a personal interest, and you mentioned the Congo a little bit. And one of the things, as you mentioned, that seems to be going on is there's sort of a proliferation of rebel movements. And in that kind of environment, it's very hard to negotiate access to the folks caught in the middle of the conflict and figure out who you're dealing with and who's responsible for what. ICRC does this more than any other organization, I suspect. How are you sort of coping with this? I remember in the early days in the late 80s when you would deal with the SPLA in the South, it was the SPLA pretty much. And you could see John Garang and you could grumble about things and work out arrangements. And that went in Angola and some other places too. But certainly now in places like the Congo and other parts of the world, you can't find that particular person or even two people who have control over what's going on out there.
I think that's a very important point, and that relates to the earlier comment I was making about the phase where conflicts were more ideological and where you would always have a very strong core within most of the opposition groups, including those that were maybe not as structured, but they had at least a political imperative. The grievances that they were about were predominantly political in nature. It was national liberation, it was the decolonization movements and issues around that, left, right, and capitalism, communism, whatever. It had to do with also a world vision that was then brought to, and a worldview that was brought back to their local context. Today, the fact is that we deal with not only fragmented groups, where, as you say, the leadership is difficult to identify, and the command and control in that sense, and the discipline within the group is incredibly difficult to establish. But it's also that the more you have a mix, or even the more a group becomes exclusively driven by criminal objectives, and therefore is there for the gain in financial and economic terms, of course, the more challenging it is to establish a link of why that group would be interested in the dialogue with you on humanitarian issues. Now, you do have some examples of groups that are, yes, predominantly engaged, but because they have control over a given territory and, a stable control, they, of course, have responsibilities then for population, and they realize that there is a dialogue to engage around what can be done to address the needs of the population. So if you have a leadership that can think in those terms, you can then establish a connection. But the reality is, in the case of Eastern DRC, that while some groups are fairly well-defined and you can engage them, others, it is already a huge challenge simply to get through the checkpoints by ensuring that your arrival has been notified and that nobody will be surprised to see you come through the village. And it also involves a lot of care that we have to take in how we provide assistance in certain regions. There are numerous examples of villages where we were providing, for instance, after people's villages were looted by armed groups who would come with cooking utensils and sort of basic commodities to reestablish, or seeds and tools for them to. And the first thing that many of these families would do is they would bury the assistance out in either the forests around the villages, because there was such a fear that the very fact that distribution had taken place would be the next round of drawing the armed groups in for a round of looting. And so we have to work on all these paradigms. And the only thing that I can say is there is, on the ICRC side, an operational philosophy that looks for this kind of dialogue. But there is also, a need in security terms to engage with these types of actors. And so we develop it because we're there for the long haul. If you do it a one-off distribution in a region, you might not need to build that dialogue quite in the same way. But if you're determined to be there for the longer term, you can't work without them in our view.
Right, no, good point. Anyway, I'm sure there's a few questions out there, so who would like to start? Please.
Thanks very much. Just
identify yourself. So he.
Mark Yarmel with Refugees International. Okay. Thanks very much for the talk. I just want to follow up on the question about.
Thank you. Not speaking loud enough. I just want to follow up on the question about remote management and the issue of proximity. And I'm back from assessment in Mogadishu. And I mean, where remote control is just essentially the way things are going with groups based in Nairobi linked up with partners in Mogadishu. And you talk to people in Nairobi and talk about all the aid that's being provided and good reports and the people that are being helped. Then you get to Mogadishu and the systemic nature of diversion and the impunity with which groups manipulate aid and steal it from displaced groups or other vulnerable populations is just remarkable. And I mean, you mentioned sort of finding the balance because you're right. I mean, you can't just having an expat presence doesn't mean that all of a sudden it's going to be an effective project. But I wonder if you can elaborate a little more on in a place like that where, entering into a context where aid manipulation has been going on for decades. How do you find that ICRC specifically kind of find the balance of, being linked with local staff and local partners, but at the same time recognizing that it's a context that's quite conducive to groups that might want to divert aid for themselves?
I think the first thing to say about that is that it's very important in our case that we have been able to, fine-tune some of the operational modalities over many years. And that includes a very strong partnership with probably the only institution that has preserved an access throughout the entire territory throughout this period in Somalia, which is the Somali Red Crescent. And interestingly, they decided as a leadership, this is quite an interesting choice that they made in the early 1990s, was at one point to decide to remove the entire leadership structure and place it in Nairobi because that was the only place from their perspective where they could be neutral. It was very interesting because wherever they would have their headquarters otherwise in this very fragmented, fractionized, and tribal environment. So they put it there and have been able, through that choice, to sustain a presence throughout the country over that period. And our own access has been through, indeed, national staff in their different communities over that period. Now, the check and balances that you need, for instance, one thing that we designed over time is when purchasing, for instance, food or seeds in the context, is to ensure that you have modalities that are very clear with those with whom you operate. So, for instance, we would never pay for the entire amount before we see it arrive on destination, and that's, of course, the transport in our case is outsourced because of security reasons. So these are local contractors that will transport, and then those who we contract with the food purchases are also in charge of the transport, so that they then are committed to make sure that this is delivered on the spot, where we then have our colleagues who will monitor the number of bags and what has arrived, and we will only pay the full amount if that has indeed arrived at the time. And any loss incurred on the way is a loss not for us, but for the one who we partnered with, we contracted it with. So they don't have an incentive to have things get lost on the way because they won't be paid for it when it arrives at the other end in that term in the same way. Now, of course, then, as you rightly say, you have to monitor that as it goes, and that may mean that there are regions, and that has happened, where if we start to detect that things are not going the way that we want, well, we have to close down the operations there. Because the point again that I want to emphasize is, you know, it is extremely costly to have diversions take place and not do anything about it, because your entire credibility in the context goes down the drain. It's just, you can't sustain a long-term presence in a context if you don't deal with those types of issues. Our national staff, by the way, because of course they're all related to the different local communities, will also be a mechanism of oversight amongst themselves. Because of course, if it's known by one of the national staff that on the other side, in the other community, they're receiving too much, or that actually, you know, there used to be in our office in Nairobi, it was a very famous fax machine, which in the context of, would spit out throughout the week complaints coming from Somalis. Because Somalis are not at all shy to share with you their concerns. So we had this fax machine. Now, of course, faxes, that was one time. Today it comes through Twitter messages. And so we get constantly throughout the week complaints about, you know, these people received too much, we didn't receive anything. And it's also a form of monitoring, because you can compare it to the types of feedbacks that you receive. So actually the fact that we get this kind of comments back is extremely useful as a check and balance in managing this. Now, it's also true that we have to be very, very careful, and in particular when the events around WFP took place, we came out very strongly for very substantial briefs to, in public terms, but also to our donor community about exactly how our processes work. And we will never claim that that means we have full control over the entire shipments. That's just, that's not reasonable to say, and it's just not the case. But that, you know, in that sense, due diligence is applied and the mechanisms is very, very important. And if we were really of the impression that we couldn't sustain that anymore because too much is disappearing, we would definitely have to stop it, because it creates so many reputation issues in other contexts. You can't separate. There are no more firewalls between contexts. People know about it instantly.
Yeah. I'm Whitney. I'm with Interaction, Humanitarian Policy and Practice Team. I'm really happy this discussion's happening. Specifically, I'm going to follow up on your question. I think there's some faces who are here. I believe you're with the Principles in Practice workshop that Interaction had about a month and a half ago. And this is totally right up its alley. And I'm going to follow up, and you're saying that it comes a certain point when you need to shut down your operations if the aid is diverted to a certain point. What my question is, what's the red line? Because it's easy to say that at a certain point it becomes too costly to stay. But what's the red line? Do you have a contingency plan within your organization that's drawn out and clear to both you and the national staff? And then a follow-up is, if you do have that, you know, in the context of things, if you leave, you know, other agencies are going to stay and fill the gap, right? So I'm thinking specifically of Darfur. Some, you know, people are expelled, people left, but people are still trying to fill the gaps, and obviously they're not filled. But in the long term, because different organizations have different mandates, it's really hard to have a strong response by leaving, because then by leaving, you're not there, you can't speak about what's going on anymore. So this happened with Doctors Without Borders in North Korea, and this one more.
That's an interesting challenge, because it's, on the one hand, I don't think that, well, I can't say that we have a, you know, a checklist where you have automatic triggers. It will be very contextualized, because you will always also relate it to the wider impact that you believe your operation has in overall terms. And, you know, the ICRC is not a single focus organization. So we have certain food assistance programs, we have medical assistance, we'll do water projects, we visit prisoners, we'll do other dialogue with the armed groups about how they conduct their operations. So you can reduce your exposure to risk through certain programs. If, for instance, like was the case in Somalia earlier this year, which wasn't the issue of diversion, but where the Al-Shabaab movement made publicly known that they didn't want us to continue our food distribution activities in the regions under their control. Now, if that had been a decision, just take your example, where we had decided to withdraw, that doesn't mean we stop all of the other projects. For instance, the very important work that we carry out through the clinics of the Somali Red Crescent, that of course provide very important medical assistance to people throughout the region, is a way of staying in a context, continuing to observe what happens, be able to speak about it. But you can come to the conclusion that the food distribution just entails too much risk, and you shut that part down for a while until you can reestablish proper channels. So the fact that we have diverse set of sort of multidisciplinary response allows us then to modulate that to the point where you don't necessarily need to, in our case, withdraw from the entire context, but you can decide to open or close. The other point that you were referring to, which I think is an absolutely factual observation, is that the reality is that there is both, you know, coordination, common work, but also a form of competition in the humanitarian sector, which will mean that agencies may make decisions to stay at certain moments, others to leave, and that we wouldn't necessarily apply the same sets of principles, which of course always allows armed groups to make with their pick and choose and their choices, if that were. But I think in the Somali case, that was somewhat contained simply because of also the challenges of access for many organizations. But you're right, in Darfur, there were certainly those types of moments where others would fill the gap. But you can also say that it is important that there are maybe different ways of working, because at the end, I think what is always going to be difficult for us, we're talking about these dilemmas because they're associated with the fact of being present. I've been asked a lot in recent days, isn't it difficult to work in Syria, and don't you have many dilemmas? I said I always prefer the dilemmas associated with being present than the ones where you're completely out of it and then have to think about how am I going to get back in. And so you try and design it. But that means I'm sure we sometimes find the right ways of dealing with those dilemmas, and sometimes I'm sure we will have failed to find the right line as well. So it's in our case, it will always be very contextualized. I don't think we'll have the automatic triggers for the context across the board.
Gary Byron with Interpress. Thank you very much. I was just wondering if you could expand briefly on the call for greater involvement by international governments in political management of armed conflicts. Maybe just discuss the rationale and perhaps how to incentivize that a little bit. And also whether there's any link to this point that you made about the rise of non-ideological groups and how those two can go together at all. Thanks.
Yeah, I think it starts with a general observation, and I, you know, I immediately admit that because we're very operationally engaged, this would require a lot more debating and research in terms of the angle that I'm trying to formulate. But I'm personally struck by the fact that we've lived through the past decade in an environment which I feel that the military reflex, the reflex of intervening to address a conflict in military terms, is the first resort in most people's minds, certainly in the Western world. I'm struck by that in the European context. It's probably related to, you know, both the mix with for very good reasons when dealing and faced with the kinds of acts of violence that we see in Syria or what we saw at the moments in other contexts where people say something has to be done about it, which is perfectly understandable and legitimate. The problem is, and you know, some of you have had much more time to research this, and so you know, you'll challenge me if you see it differently, but I don't think there's an extraordinarily compelling track record of military interventions achieving stability. So if that were the case, we would probably be doing a lot of lessons learned around that and saying, yes, there's a good case to you know, prove that when there is a military intervention, actually it ends conflict and it ends violence. So you can say, yes, Libya last year, okay. Talk about Kosovo in 99, yes, which both had fairly similar characteristics in terms of, you know, other boots on the ground and air force involved. But it's not a general standard that one can say one can apply. So the question is, if that isn't the case, my concern is about what will lead to better prospects for that. And I know there's, because we live in times which are very impatient, because, you know, the news is so immediately and instantly accessible. So we think about a crisis starts on Monday, has to be solved on Friday, which, of course, we would all like, but it isn't the reality of the world we live in. And therefore, the patience for the political engagement needs to be there. I'm struck personally, this is again a personal view, by let us think about all the things that we've read over the last 10 years about Afghanistan. So what we've read is the various analyses and debates around, you know, the correct military strategies. We've all read about whether counterterrorism would be the right way, whatever. And that is certainly legitimate to have public debates around that. The others was all about the reconstruction strategies and whether or not it was the right way. But I personally have not read many articles about the correct political strategies to involve, you know, stabilizing not just the government, but thinking about the future of Afghanistan's political architecture. That I personally read much less about. And so I'm struck about the fact that we seem to live in a time where the military and the reconstruction elements are there, or the development and humanitarian, but that the political paradigm is less put forward. And I've asked myself, why does that seem to be the case, and what can be some of the explanations for this long duration of many of the conflicts? And again, I think, in part, this is certainly my hypothesis, is that it is related to the nature of the armed conflicts, which are internal and which are deeply fragmented and therefore very difficult to organize political processes around, which is an objective fact, I think. It's, we're just talking about DRC. You know, how difficult is it to bring all these groups around sort of a national table to think about the political future of the country? It is incredibly challenging. But I still think that ways have to be found where the international community comes together around things like that. And, of course, the Syrian example, which is so polarized, also in international terms, I think is, again, an indication around that. So my point is more in search of new avenues. It's not at all that I have the response to that, but I'm just very concerned because we are present in so many contexts where we also have, we keep facing the questions about, so ICRC and other humanitarians, how long are you going to stay there and when are you handing over? Well, it is a correct question to ask, but at the same time, it is certainly, we're not in the phase of the linear debates, the so-called continuum between humanitarian assistance and development, because when you have a 30-year-long conflict, well, it isn't quite the same as if you talk about Bosnia pre-Dayton and Bosnia post-Dayton. That's, you can then academically, and concretely draw a line to say, on a certain date in November 95, a peace agreement was signed and there was a before and after. Where is the before and after in South Sudan, apart from independence? Where is the before and after, even in the case of Afghanistan, etc.? So this is the challenge. That's why, maybe just in the hope that political processes could lead to that more in the future, again, I guess.
Jeremy.
I was interested by your point on some of the new actors that you're beginning to, the ICRC is beginning to see in some of the, particularly the more difficult contexts. And I think, we all saw in Somalia that there were many, many new groups that came in to try and provide aid, especially given some of the difficulties that a lot of the traditional actors had with access. So I want to share an observation or two that our team had and get your thoughts on kind of where this engagement with those new entrants is headed. Because as you put it, I think the way you put it was, we don't want just to bring them to our table, we want to go to their table. Our teams, and particularly the Somalis on our team, who are very, very seasoned, were hugely unimpressed by what they saw out of most of these groups in Mogadishu. Practices that were, there were some of the new entrants who knew what they were doing, and many who were really kind of fly by night, very new, frankly made the situation more challenging for a lot of the more established actors because they played by a different set of rules or didn't play by any set of rules. And what I wonder with some of these new entrants, and what I'm curious about your point of view on, is are these groups sort of in general at the same point that the, if you will, mainstream humanitarian community was at in the 70s and 80s, where we were heavily motivated by goodwill but not very professional, hadn't thought through some of these dilemmas very well, and just had to learn the very, very hard way what not to do and what to do? And are the differences between how we are operating, how they are operating, reflective of that more, or are they reflective of an actual fundamental disagreement about how aid should be done? Do you see this as a learning process, or do you see this as something where, so a learning process where at the end of which many of them will probably end up closer to where the mainstream humanitarian community is, or is it something where these are kind of intractable disagreements or intractable differences and points of view that are not going to shift or are not going to shift greatly. And so we need to discuss sort of where we have some common ground, but not expect a lot of change in sort of the fundamental way of operating or approaching the work.
Overly impressed with the results. And the problem about working in an organization that is 150 years old is that we've probably said that about most organizations at a certain moment in our history, you know, kind of the well-established lecturing the others and saying, they will not survive. They're not really very professional. So that's the beauty of being 150. But I think, of course, that is part of it. And to be very honest, I couldn't now present to you an overview in detailed fashion of how effective many of these organizations have been. But I'm struck by the fact that I'm sometimes confronted with questions by, including by donors, who would say, but aren't you concerned about the fact that you have these new actors on the ground who seem not to be coordinating very closely? You know, that's another issue that we've been, of course, accompanied with over the last decade at least, is the discussions on coordination. And it's interesting because what I normally say to that is, again, I can't, you know, describe in detail how effective they've been, but at least we have to give them the credit that they've tried to go into the difficult context, whereas the traditional coordination mechanisms are indeed in Nairobi, where these, like now, they are in Bamako, and, well, the real work is happening in the north and has to take place somehow. So, I think what you said then in the second part of the comment is a very important point. I think some of these actors will now, as we all do, make their mistakes, learn from it, but the change, I think, is irreversible. And the reason why I think the change is irreversible is also because it's not simply that a few countries or agencies happen to find a bit of money and thought, let's see what we can do. But it's also the reflection of profound changes in the way in which some of the countries see their contribution to international affairs.
I have a bit of a concern about, I think I agree with everything you said. I think there's a concern that, you know, the main international system coordinated through the UN is not supposed to be and was not envisioned as a Western system. It was envisioned as a global system. And, you know, to some extent, the reason it has looked like a Western system is that most of the main, you know, outside of the UN, most of the main actors have been based in Western countries, due largely to just the absence of major actors from anywhere else. Now that we are seeing the emergence of some major actors from anywhere else, I think it's really critical that that system find a way to integrate them, or otherwise this perception that it's a Western system sort of becomes true, even if it frankly wasn't really before. And if we view, there's a risk if the OIC, for example, becomes sort of a parallel or alternate coordinating mechanism, then you do get, you do no longer have a global system. You just have like a Western system and a Middle and sort of an Islamic or Middle Eastern or whatever you, however you want to call it, system. And I think that would be a real failing.
I think that's good. Valerie Amos deserves a lot of credit for having understood exactly that, and she's trying very actively to reach out. Has gone on field trips where she has invited agencies from different parts of African and Middle Eastern backgrounds to try and reach out. And she may actually over time be successful in part of that. But I think what we have to not underestimate from where we come from historically is that, of course, the beauty about saying that something is universal is, in particular, when you think that it's applied to everybody else, which is what most countries feel when we say universal. They say, well, what you mean is it applies to us, right? And frankly, if we look at the last decade in terms of Western projection and how we dealt with, you know, for instance, universal legal norms, the Geneva Conventions that I was talking about earlier, but we also had our debates here and in Western Europe, in Europe at large, about if when your own security is at risk, the law is put on the back burner, that's not a very good message about universality, because the actual test of universality is when it applies at home. That's when it's universal. It's not when you say that, you know, the law applies to everybody else. And this, I think, in the humanitarian system now, putting politics aside, that's exactly what we have collectively also projected. This is our table. We've been here. You're now emerging. We may invite you to the table. But I think this is why I think we have to go out to other tables. Because when you discuss this in China, what they will say is, if you come to me saying this is a universal value, I know what you're saying. It's a Western value. You know, you can make a very, very long speech. It's a bit like when the ICRC tries to explain that its emblem is not a religious emblem in some places. You make a huge effort, and you still convince the audience that it is, because it's a cross on the background. So you can, you know, in some contexts, you can make a very, very long explanation. People will see. You can make on universality a very long case for it, but since people don't feel that you have always associated them in the past to your own thinking, your conceptual developments, your... Well, currently, and we see that in the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement. There was a conference of Red Cross and Red Crescent in Algiers in 2004 where that was formulated in no uncertain terms. The national societies of Africa, both Crescents and Cross, said to the International Federation, to the ICRC, and to national societies in the North, the time is over when you came to our countries and simply dictated things the way you thought they were going to happen. So I'm sure we did all of that under the notion of universality, but the fact is that's not how it was received. And so now is the time of some others to be part of shaping things.
I'm Carrie Santos from the American Red Cross, and maybe I'll make a pitch for our Red Cross and Red Crescent movement and the federation that unites us all. There is a professionalization going on. We have some extremely strong Red Crescent societies, including Turkish Red Crescent, Palestinian Red Crescent, Iranian Red Crescent. And what you see is good staff who've been working on disasters and crises for 20, 30 years. They get hired. They go to Geneva. They work for the Federation Secretariat. And then they come back. They've been hired by Qatari Red Crescent. They've been hired by Kuwaiti Red Crescent. They may not be Kuwaiti or Qatari, but they bring in Arab and Muslim voices into their societies to help them run the show. And we have learning going on for some time. And in addition, we have significant leadership of Red Crescent in our structures. The vice president for the Federation, who covers all of Asia, all of the Middle East, is the Qatari Red Crescent. And this was seen as a very important vote in 2011 when they won this position, because it showed, one, they were politically ambitious. They wanted to be involved in our arcane structures that are in the Federation going back to 1919. And they wanted to use it for their own ends. That's great. We want them at the table. So they're at the table, and it's not even us, them. We all sit around together. And sometimes they do things differently. But especially when you're talking to Iranian or Turkish Red Crescent, these are incredibly respected professionals, and we have to listen to what they're saying. And when we're in their country, we do it their way.
Just to follow up on this comment, I'm Asa Piaka from USAID's Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance. On this issue of coordination with non-traditional or non-OECD DAC donors, I did see some progress earlier in the year. We, from AID's perspective, we signed an MOU with ESHAD. We brought in the director of ESHAD, and we had discussions around sort of shared technical exchanges and ways to better work together at an operational level, sharing sort of best practices, things of that nature. But then I thought I saw sort of a diminution of that in the Syria context, or I should say that the traditional donors had a lot of challenges in terms of understanding what the OIC and their partners were doing in Syria. And we had a lot of difficulty gathering information about so-called $100 million of pledges and where that money was translating to actual action on the ground. So I think there's a lot of parallel action at the donor level taking place on these issues. And I see some progress, but I think, just to echo what else has been said, there remain challenges. And I think one, from my own personal perspective, I see value in coordination, but I also see some value in having a diversity of actors out there and a different role that some of the new actors could play. So,
I'll throw one out there. Thanks, Pierre. It's interesting. And one of the things that we haven't talked about in the neutrality sort of the discussion, and one of the things that was always complicating for us and for you in particular, and I remember going back to Iraq in 2003 when your first worker was killed there, heading to the airport, leaving Baghdad in August. 2003. In that time period, you probably lost others there before. And I remember the head of the country delegation was extremely shaken by that, because you prided yourself on your neutrality, working both factions, and here this supposed random act of violence occurs. And we haven't talked about that today, because I think that's one of the things that has changed in this community significantly. When I started out in this field years ago, that was why we had neutrality, because it protected us. But now we have actors out there who don't care about neutrality. They kill for the sake of killing. And how does that affect your operational capabilities and modalities?
No, that's a huge, hugely important element in any operational modality or design that we develop. Because you're right, I think the statistics, well, our own, or in particular also what has been documented by others, Humanitarian Outcomes and others in their recent reports about the numbers of humanitarians killed, injured, or kidnapped in recent years. In particular, the instances of kidnapping have been on the rise very significantly. And you're right, that there is a mix between, I think, the more political forms of rejection by some of the maybe radical, in particular, non-state armed groups, but also the criminal component, of course, that is there. And that this year we did lose one of our colleagues who was taken hostage in Pakistan, who was then murdered, which was the first time we failed to bring a hostage back home alive, which was very difficult also for the entire team. In Pakistan, we had another colleague killed in the context of Yemen. That was a very unlucky death as a result of an airstrike, which injured him fatally, but in ways that were very, very unlucky, so it was not a deliberate targeting. So you have the mix. You have the reality of the danger of working in contexts where you can be caught in a crossfire or in an incident. But you do have a number of recent instances over the last decade of targeted attacks against humanitarians. Now, we have to say that also existed in the 90s. We had a very bad year in 96 with six of our colleagues murdered in Chechnya, three in Burundi, which is probably the worst single year we had in that. So there are things that are changing because of the nature of the conflicts that we work in, and I think we've spoken about some of those. And it's the risks are continue. I think what neutrality is about, and the challenge that it faces, is that it's under pressure from a multiplicity of events. So we've just talked about the direct forms of, you know, violent rejection, but you also have a number of countries that, in a way, do no longer believe that they should be welcoming humanitarian actors from outside. They believe that a national humanitarian response is what is called for in the future. Now, that is their way of limiting the access to their country of independent humanitarian agencies that may indeed observe circumstances that they don't want to see observed in their own country. So that is another form of rejection of humanitarian action. But then I do continue to think that at the other end of the spectrum, when you have discussions about that, you know, we've had in a number of countries around, for instance, the notion of material support for the whole debate that you had here also around Holder and others. That is a big issue in itself, because what it says is that, of course, while it's absolutely legitimate that a country will take every measure to protect its own civilians from threat and risk, and that, of course, any donor would want to make sure that money that it's providing to agencies doesn't fall into the wrong hands, which is, I think, a very shared concern that we would have also. At the other hand, we have been historically also mandated to work precisely with engagement with all of the parties. Now, if that starts to be questioned in a broad definition of material support, well, then you have the pressures that start to happen at all ends of the equation, just as, frankly, the integration of humanitarian assistance into counterinsurgency strategies is an issue. I always give this example that was a few years ago, but it's still very valid, I think, and also for the future risks, when leaflets were dropped in Afghanistan on villages where the message on it was saying that, you know, in exchange for information on the whereabouts of so-and-so, your villages will receive humanitarian assistance. Well, by that time, the next day, you have your own teams going through. Well, of course, the distinction between what is foreign military humanitarian, what is foreign humanitarian in the neutral sense, becomes a huge challenge to present. And so we continuously face these kind of questions, because I think the underlying assumption is that humanitarian agencies don't have only one motive. I think most people think that. And it's not because you have an emblem that is the Red Cross or any other, that today, by definition, you will be accepted better. That's why I always say there is no such thing as a pre-existing humanitarian space. It's not as if you drive into Darfur and then you suddenly pass, there's a sign, sorry, on the side of the road saying you're now entering humanitarian space. It was the Twilight Zone that was before, but you create the space. How do you create space? You create space by dialogue, hopefully by quality programs, by recognition, by local communities that your presence is useful for them. And then that influences other actors to say, well, you know, we should probably not deal with these. And by the way, they have always said that they would be even-handed, and now that we've seen them around for a while, that's actually verified by our own observations. But there is no such thing as declaring a humanitarian space and you move into it and you can... No, it's a lot of work to create that in today's environment. And that's why this balancing act between the impact we may achieve and the risks that we are ready to expose our own teams to is probably one of the most challenging that we have on a continuous basis, because... That's why you were referring to the 12,000 staff that we have internationally. Every single moment during the day, somewhere around the world, you know, ICRC teams, and for that matter of many other agencies, move into harm's way. And how they negotiate, how they manage to get through, how they convince the different parties in DRC and Afghanistan and elsewhere that our motives are indeed non-political, well, that is challenged by a number of actions by others. And frankly, I think in the humanitarian system we also contribute to that, because we're perfectly capable, as we saw again last year in Ivory Coast, to have agencies that will, on the Monday, criticize the UN for its military humanitarian role, and on the Friday call on the same UN to provide military escorts for humanitarian agencies to go out into regions to provide distribution. So of course, by that, the humanitarian agencies are also sometimes contributing to a blurring of lines that is exactly the point that I was making earlier about Afghanistan. How many agencies will preserve a capacity to operate without the security umbrella? And that'll be a big test. So, you know, I'm not putting all those challenges on the same footing, because it's different to have a group attack you deliberately than to have a debate about the notion of material assistance, material support. But all of this does inform the context in which we are. And to preserve neutrality in the middle of that, it's hard work, very hard work.
Well, great, because this is a whole other side of this very complex equation that you've outlined very nicely for all of us. And it might be a whole can of worms, but it's about the whole issue of funding of ICRC activities. And I'm wondering if, and you can address this very briefly because I know it's complex, but us donors are increasingly, and for the past, over a very long period of time, have been resorting to earmarked funds for very specific programs and sub-programs. And does this leave enough, and of course, you know, the humanitarian appeals, the consolidated appeals process, I wonder if you find that that leaves enough leeway for a determination of where funding for specific programs should actually be implemented and dispersed. Or do you also, like other humanitarian agencies, feel a little bit constrained from earmarked to specific programs, which are sometimes made in other capitals? The idea of earmarked funds are made elsewhere, not really in direct, cognizance of what is actually required at a very specific time on the ground.
I think ICRC has a donor base that continues to provide, I think for the moment, a good mix of very loosely or sometimes even unearmarked funds. Some funds which are geographically earmarked in terms of a region, then the country. We will go to certain combinations, country and program, but we won't go below in terms also of what we accept. And the reason for that is, I think, exactly related to what you're saying, is the reason why it's so important to have also very loosely earmarked funds is that we have presence in 80 countries, in many contexts also, which of course nobody ever focuses on, frankly speaking, in the course of the average day. Now, there are some donors that fund contexts like the Central African Republic, but prison visits in Madagascar, you really need to work very hard on that one. And if it were not, including for what the U.S., particularly in this case, State Department PRM funding, gives us in terms of that flexibility of the use of the money, there are many operations which simply couldn't be run throughout the year. So in my position, this is one of the great advantages, because the ICRC works on a modality where we authorize our teams in every country around the world to start spending on the 1st of December, 1st of January, before we've actually received the first money that comes in. Now, that is also based on a very strong relation with donors, and we try to work on the predictability of the funding side. But that means we need to take partly at the beginning of the year a financial risk of our own to engage, because if otherwise, all of the operations would be delayed until the money actually comes in. And if it's then tied to specific contexts, it becomes more complicated. Now, at the same time, we also have to recognize that for a given donor to simply give an agency, even like the ICRC, simply an unearmarked amount of money, and then you have in the middle of the year, say, Syria appear, and then ask by its parliament, well, what are you doing about this? And you say, well, we gave the ICRC an unearmarked amount in the beginning of the year, so we presume they'll be using some of it for Syria. Of course, that doesn't work either. So we have to reconcile both the non-earmarked fund that we will continue to really lobby for, because it allows us to cover many crises that are very forgotten, with, of course, accepting country earmarking for a number of operations throughout the year. But we'll also be always very clear to our donors when we have covered a given appeal. So, for instance, right now we have covered our Syria appeal very well, and that we do no longer need to call for funds on that. We don't want to have overspending on that. We prefer then to talk to donors to redirect funds to other places. So it's a continuous discussion throughout the year that is taking place. But without the unearmarked funds, there would be many places we would just have to shut out. But it's a lot of hard work throughout the year, but it's,
Well, Pierre, I know you have, they're keeping you very busy all day and for the next few days in different meetings. So we appreciate that you could come here and chat with us a bit. I mean, we all are going to be facing these kinds of issues that we touched on today for a very long time. And I think the more often we can get together and talk about them and exchange views and ideas, the better off it is. So we really appreciate that you could be here. Take a read this thing. They've got some good information in it. And please join me in thanking Pierre.